wear it in pride, for it was a jacket like those worn by the men with whom he marched. "I have seen men do brave things," he wrote, "and they ask for nothing." And he added, "It's not hard to love men for the things they endure, and for the words they do not speak." More and more, too, there crept into the journal the comments of the professional soldier between the prayers and the scruples. Criticism of command, of brag after Chickamauga, satisfaction and an impersonal pride in maneuver or gunnery, the practice of Marlowe's battery, excellent. And finally, the admiration for the feints and delays executed by Johnston's virtuosity on the approaches to Atlanta, at Buzzard's Roost, Snake Creek Gap, New Hope Church, Kennesaw Mountain. There is always a kind of glory, however strained or obscured, in whatever man's hand does well, and General Johnston does well. Then, outside Atlanta, the bullet found him. He lay in the hospital and rotted slowly to death. But even before the infection set in, when the wound in the leg seemed scarcely serious, he knew that he would die. "I shall die," he wrote in the journal, "and shall be spared the end and the last bitterness of war. I have lived to do no man good, and have seen others suffer for my sin. I do not question the justice of God, that others have suffered for my sin, for it may be that only by the suffering of the innocent does God affirm that men are brothers, and brothers in his holy name. And in this room with me now, men suffer for sins not theirs, as for their own. It's a comfort to know that I suffer only for my own." He knew not only that he was to die, but that the war was over. "It is over. It is all over but the dying, which will yet go on. Though the boil has come to a head and has burst, yet must the pus flow. Men shall come together yet, and die in the common guilt of man, and in the guilt that sent them hither from far places and distant firesides. But God in his mercy has spared me the end. Blessed be his name." There was no more in the journal. There was only the letter to Gilbert, written in the strange hand, dictated by Cass after he had grown too weak to write. "Remember me, but without grief. If one of us is lucky, it is I." Atlanta fell. In the last confusion, the grave of Cass Mastern was not marked. Someone at the hospital, a certain Albert Calloway, kept Cass's papers and the ring which he had carried on the cord around his neck, and much later, after the war, in fact, sent them to Gilbert Mastern with a courteous note. Gilbert preserved the journal, the letters from Cass, the picture of Cass, and the ring on its cord, and after Gilbert's death, the heir finally sent the packet to Jack Burden, the student of history. So they came to rest on the little pine table in Jack Burden's bedroom, in the slatternly apartment which he occupied with the two other graduate students, the unlucky, industrious, sad, alcoholic one, and the lucky, idle, and alcoholic one. Jack Burden lived with the Mastern papers for a year and a half. He wanted to know all of the facts of the world in which Cass and Gilbert Mastern had lived, and he did know many of the facts, and he felt that he knew Gilbert Mastern. Gilbert Mastern had kept no journal, but Jack Burden felt that he knew him, the man with a head like the block of bare granite, who had lived through one world into another and had been at home in both. But the day came when Jack Burden sat down at the pine table and realized that he did not know Cass Mastern. He did not have to know Cass Mastern to get the degree. He only had to know the facts about Cass Mastern's world. But without knowing Cass Mastern, he could not put down the facts about Cass Mastern's world. Not that Jack Burden said that to himself. He simply sat there at the pine table night after night, staring at the photograph and writing nothing. Then he would get up to get a drink of water and would stand in the dark kitchen, holding an old jelly glass in his hand, waiting for the water to run cold from the tap. I have said that Jack Burden could not put down the facts about Cass Mastern's world because he did not know Cass Mastern. Jack Burden did not say definitely to himself why he did not know Cass Mastern, but I, who am what Jack Burden became, look back now, years later, and try to say why. Cass Mastern lived for a few years, and in that time he learned that the world is all of one piece. He learned that the world is like an enormous spider web, and if you touch it, however lightly, at any point, the vibration ripples to the remotest perimeter and the drowsy spider feels the tingle and is drowsy no more, but springs out to fling the gossamer coils about you who have touched the web, and then inject the black, numbing poison under your hide. It doesn't matter whether or not you meant to brush the web of things. Your happy foot or your gay wing may have brushed it ever so lightly, but what happens always happens, and there's the spider, bearded black and with his great faceted eyes glittering like mirrors in the sun or like God's eye, and the fangs dripping. But how could Jack Burden, being what he was, understand that? He could read the words written many years before in the lonely plantation house, after Cass Mastern had freed his slaves, or in the lawyer's room in Jackson, Mississippi, or by candlelight in the hotel room in Vicksburg after the conversation with Jefferson Davis, or by the dying campfire in some bivouac, while the forms of men lay stretched on the ground in the night around, and the night was filled with a slow, sad, susurrous rustle, like the wind fingering the pines, which was not, however, the sound of wind in the pines, but the breath of thousands of sleeping men. Jack Burden could read those words, but how could he be expected to understand them? They could only be words to him, for to him the world then was simply an accumulation of items, odds and ends of things, like the broken and misused and dust-shrouded things gathered in a garret. Or it was a flux of things before his eyes, or behind his eyes, and one thing had nothing to do in the end with anything else. Or perhaps he laid aside the journal of Cass Mastern, not because he could not understand, but because he was afraid to understand, for what might be understood there was a reproach to him. In any case, he laid aside the journal and entered upon one of the periods of the great sleep. He would come home in the evening, and because he knew that he could not work, he would go to bed immediately. He would sleep 12 hours, 14 hours, 15 hours, feeling himself, while asleep, plunge deeper and deeper into sleep, like a diver groping downward into dark water, feeling for something which may be there and which would glitter if there were any light in the depth, but there isn't any light. Then in the morning he would lie in bed, not wanting anything, not even hungry, hearing the small sounds of the world sneaking and seeping back into the room, under the door, through the glass, through the cracks in the wall, through the very pores of the wood and plaster. Then he would think, "If I don't get up, I can't go back to bed." And he would get up and go out into a world which seemed very unfamiliar, but with a tantalizing unfamiliarity like the world of boyhood to which an old man returns. Then one morning he went out into that world and did not come back to the room and the pine table. The black books in which the journal was written, the ring, the photograph, the packet of letters were left there, beside the thick stack of manuscript, the complete works of Jack Burden, which was already beginning to curl at the edges under the paperweight. Some weeks later, the landlady of the apartment sent him a big parcel, collect, containing the stuff he had left on the little pine table. The parcel, unopened, traveled around with him from furnished room to furnished room, to the apartment where he lived for a while with his beautiful wife Lois, until the time came when he just walked out the door and didn't come back, to the other furnished rooms and hotel rooms, a big squarish parcel with the brown paper turning yellow and the cord sagging and the name Mr. Jack Burden fading slowly. Chapter 5. That was the end of my first journey into the enchantments of the past, my first job of historical research. It was, as I have indicated, not a success, but the second job was a sensational success. It was the case of the upright judge, and I had every reason to congratulate myself on a job well done. It was a perfect research job, marred in its technical perfection by only one thing. It meant something. It all began, as I have said, when the boss, sitting in the black Cadillac which sped through the night, said to me who was what Jack Burden, the student of history, had grown up to be, "There is always something." And I said, "Maybe not on the judge." And he said, "Man is conceived in sin and born in corruption, and he passeth from the stink of the Dighty to the stench of the shroud, there is always something. The black Cadillac made its humming sound through the night, and the tires sang on the slab, and the black fields streaked with mist swept by. Sugar Boy was hunched over the wheel, which looked too big for him, and the boss sat straight up there in the front seat. I could see the black mass of his head against the tunnel of light down which we raced. Then I dozed off. It was the stopping of the car that woke me up. I realized that we were back at the Stark place. I crawled out of the car. The boss was already out, standing in the yard just inside the gate in the starlight. Sugar Boy was locking the car doors. When I went into the yard, the boss said, "Sugar Boy is going to sleep on the couch downstairs, but there's a cot made up for you upstairs. Second door on the left at the head of the stairs. You better get some shut-eye, for tomorrow you start digging for what the judge dropped." "It'll be a long dig," I said. "Look here," he said. "If you don't want to do it, you don't have to. I can always pay somebody else, or do you want a raise?" "No, I don't want a raise," I said. "I'm raising you $100 a month, whether you want it or not." "Give it to the church," I said. "If I wanted money, I could think of easier ways to make it than the way I make it with you." "So you work for me because you love me?" the boss said. "I don't know why I work for you, but it's not because I love you, and not for money." "No," he said, standing there in the dark. "You don't know why you work for me, but I know," he said, and laughed. Sugar Boy came into the yard, said good night, and went on to the house. "Why?" I asked. "Boy," he said, "you work for me because I'm the way I am and you're the way you are. It's an arrangement founded on the nature of things." "That's a hell of a fine explanation." "It's not an explanation," he said, and laughed again. "There ain't any explanations, not of anything. All you can do is point at the nature of things, if you're smart enough to see 'em." "I'm not smart enough," I said. "You're smart enough to dig up whatever it is on the judge." "There may not be anything." "Nuts," he said. "Go to bed." "Aren't you coming to bed?" "No," he said. And I left him walking across the yard in the dark, with his head bowed a little, and his hands clasped behind him, walking casually as though he had come out to stroll through the park on Sunday afternoon. But it was not afternoon, it was 3:15 a.m. I lay on the cot upstairs, but I didn't go right to sleep. I thought about Judge Irwin, about the way he'd looked at me that very night from his tall old head, the way the yellow eyes had glittered and the lip curled over the strong old yellow teeth as he said, "I'm dining with your mother this week. Shall I tell her you still like your work?" But that didn't last, and I saw him sitting in the long room in the White House by the sea, leaning over a chessboard, facing the scholarly attorney. And he wasn't an old man, he was a young man, and the high, aquiline, florid face was brooding over the board. But that didn't last, and the face leaned toward me among the stems of the tall gray marsh grass in the damp, gray, wintry dawn and said, "You ought to have led that duck more, Jack. You got to lead a duck, son. But, son, I'll make a duck hunter out of you yet." And the face smiled. And I wanted to speak out and demand, "Is there anything, Judge? Will I find anything?" But the face only smiled, and I went to sleep. Before it could say anything, I went to sleep in the middle of the smile. Then it was another day, and I set out to dig up the dead cat, to excavate the maggot from the cheese, to locate the canker in the rose, to find the deceased fly among the raisins in the rice pudding. I found it. But not all at once. You don't find it all at once if you're hunting for it. It's buried under the sad detritus of time, where no doubt it belongs. And you don't want to find it all at once, not if you're a student of history. If you found it all at once, there'd be no opportunity to use your technique. But I had an opportunity to use my technique. I took the first step the next afternoon while I sat in a beer parlor in the city, surrounded by a barricade of empty beer bottles. I lighted a fresh cigarette from the butt of the last one and asked myself the following question. For what reason, barring original sin, is a man most likely to step over the line? I answered ambition, love, fear, money. I asked, is the judge ambitious? I answered, no. An ambitious man is a man who wants other people to think he's great. The judge knows he's great and doesn't care what other people think. I asked, what about love? I was perfectly sure that the judge had had his innings, but I was also perfectly sure that nobody around the landing had anything on him in that respect. For if anybody in a small town has anything on anybody, it isn't long before everybody knows it. I asked, is the judge a man to scare easy? I answered, he does not scare easy. That left money. So I asked, does the judge love money? All the money the judge wants is just enough money to make the judge happy. I asked, was there ever a time when the judge didn't have enough money to make the judge happy? But naturally, that wouldn't be chicken feed. I lighted another cigarette and turned that question over in my mind. I didn't know the answer. Some voice out of my childhood whispered, but I couldn't catch what it said. I had the vague sense, rising from a depth of time and of myself, of being a child, of entering the room where the grown people were, of knowing that they had just that instant stopped talking because I had come into the room and was not supposed to know what they were talking about. Had I overheard what they'd been talking about? I listened for the voice whispering out of my childhood, but that voice was a long way off. It couldn't give me the answer. So I rose from the table and left the empty beer bottles and the cigarette butts and went out into the street, which still steamed from the late afternoon shower like a Turkish bath, and where now the tires of automobiles hissed hotly through the film of moisture on the asphalt. If we were lucky, there might be a breeze off the Gulf later. If we were lucky. I got a taxi, finally, and said, corner South 5th and St. Etienne Street, and fell back on the leather to listen to the tires hiss through the wetness like something frying in a skillet. I was riding to the answer about the judge, if the man who had the answer would tell me. The man was the man who had been the judge's close friend for many a year, his other self, his Damon, his Jonathan, his brother. That man was the man who had been the scholarly attorney. He would know. I stood on the pavement in front of the Mexican restaurant, where the jukebox made the jelly-like air palpitate, and paid my taxi and turned to look up at the third floor of the building, which vibrated around the jukebox. The signs were still up there, hung by wire from the little iron balcony, nailed to the wall, wooden boards painted different colors, some white, some red, some black, some green, with lettering in contrasted colors. A big sign hanging from the balcony said, God is not mocked. Another sign said, now is the day of salvation. Yeah, I said to myself, he still lives here. He lived there above a spick restaurant, and nigger children played naked in the next block among starving cats, and nigger women sat on the steps after the sun got low and fanned right slow with palm leaf fans. I reached for a cigarette as I prepared to enter the doorway of the stairs, but found I had none. So I went into the restaurant where the jukebox was grinding to a halt. To the old woman, who stood behind the beer bar squatly like a keg, and whose eyebrows were very thorny and white against the brown Mexican skin and black rebozo, I said, Cigarrillos? ¿Qué tipo? She asked. Lucky, I said, and as she laid them before me, I pointed upward and asked, The old man, is he upstairs? But she looked blank, so I said, ¿Está arriba el viejo? And felt pleased with myself for getting it off. ¿Quién sabe? She replied. ¿Viene o va? So he came and went, upon the Lord's business. Then a voice said in tolerable English from the shadows at the end of the bar, The old man has gone out. Thank you, I replied to the old man, a Mexican, who was propped there in a chair. I turned back to the old woman and said, Give me a beer, and pointed at the spigot. While I drank the beer, I looked up above the counter and saw another one of the signs, painted on a big slab of plywood or something of the sort, hanging from a nail. The background of the sign was bright red. There were blue scrolls of flowers in relief in the upper corners. The lettering was in black, highlighted in white. It said, Repent ye, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Matthew 3:2. I pointed to the sign. De'el? I asked. The old man's, huh? Si, senor, the old woman said, then added irrelevantly, Es como un santito. He may be a saint, I agreed, but he's also nuts. Nuts? Es loco, I explained. Es nuts. She said nothing to that, and I continued with the beer until the old Mexican at the end of the bar suddenly said, Look, here comes the old one. Turning, I saw the black-clothed figure through the dingy glass of the door. Then the door pushed open and he entered, older than I remembered, the white patches of hair hanging damply from under the old Panama hat, the steel-rimmed spectacles dangerously loose on the nose and the pale eyes behind, the shoulders stooped and drawn together as though pulled by the obscene, disjunctive, careful weight of the belly, as though it were the heavy tray or satchel worn by some hawker on a street corner. The black coat did not button across the belly. He stood there, blinking gravely at me, apparently not recognizing me, for he had come from the last sunshine into the dimness of the restaurant. "Good evening, senor," the old Mexican said to the scholarly attorney. "Buenas tardes," the woman said. The scholarly attorney took off his Panama and turned to the woman and bowed slightly, with a motion of the head which stirred suddenly in my mind the picture of the long room in the White House by the sea, the picture of a man, the same but different, younger, the hair not gray, in that room. "Good evening," he said to the woman, and then turning to the old Mexican, repeated, "Good evening, sir." The old Mexican pointed at me, and he said, "He waits." At that, the scholarly attorney first, I believe, really observed me. But he didn't recognize me, blinking at me in the dimness. Certainly he had no reason to expect to find me there. "Hello," I said. "Don't you know me?" "Yes," he said, and continued to peer at me. He offered me his hand, and I took it. It was clammy in my grasp. "Let's get out of here," I said. "Do you want the bread?" the old Mexican asked. The scholarly attorney turned to him. "Yes, thank you, if it's convenient." The Mexican rose, went to the end of the counter, and took a largish brown paper bag full of something and handed it to the other. "Thank you," the scholarly attorney said. "Thank you very much, sir."
"De nada," the Mexican said, bowing.
"I wish you a good evening,"
the scholarly attorney said, and bowed to the man, then to the woman, with an inclination of the head which again twitched the old recollection in me of the room in the White House by the sea.
This ends Disc 8, All the King's Men, Disc 9.
Then I followed him out of the restaurant into the street. Across the street lay the little park of trampled brown grass, now glistening with moisture, where the bums sat on benches and the pigeons cooed softly like an easy conscience, and defecated in delicate little lime-white pinches on the cement around the fountain. I looked at the pigeons, then at the bulged-open bag, which I observed was full of bread crusts. "Are you going to feed the pigeons?" I asked.
"No, it is for George," he said, moving toward the doorway that led above.
"You keeping a dog?"
"No,"
he said, and led the way into the vestibule and up the wooden stairs.
"What is George, then, a parrot?"
"No,"
he said wheezily, for the stairs were steep.
"George is an unfortunate."
That meant, I remembered, a bum. An unfortunate is a bum who is fortunate enough to get his foot inside a softy's door and stay there. If he gets a good berth, he's promoted from bum to unfortunate. The scholarly attorney had, on several occasions before, taken in unfortunates. One unfortunate had popped the organist down at the mission where the scholarly attorney operated. Another unfortunate had lifted his watch and Phi Beta Kappa key. So George was another unfortunate. I looked at the bread and said, "Well, he must be pretty unfortunate if that's what he's got to eat."
"He eats some of it," the scholarly attorney said, "but that is almost accidental. He uses it in his work, but some of it slips down, I'm sure, and that's why he is never hungry, except for sweets," he added.
"How in God's name does he use bread crusts in his work, and the bread crusts slip down his throat?"
"Do not take the name of the Lord in vain,"
he said, and added,
George's work, it's very clever and artistic, you'll see.
I saw. We got to the top of the second flight, turned in the narrow hall under the cracked skylight, and entered a door. There was what I took to be George, in one corner of the big, sparsely furnished room, sitting tailor fashion on a piece of old blanket, with a couple of big mixing bowls in front of him and a big piece of plywood about 2 feet by 4 lying on the floor by him. George looked up when we came in and said,
"I ain't got any more bread."
"Here it is," the scholarly attorney said, and took the brown bag to him. George emptied the crusts into one of the bowls, then stuck a piece into his mouth and began to chew soberly and purposively. He was a fair-sized, muscular man, with a hell of a strong-looking neck, and the tendons in his neck worked and pulled slickly while he chewed. He had yellow hair, almost gone, and a smooth, flat face with blue eyes. While he chewed, he just looked straight ahead at a spot across the room.
"What's he do that for?" I asked.
"He's making an angel."
"Well," I said, and just then George leaned forward over one of the bowls and let the thoroughly masticated bread drop from his mouth into the bowl. Then he put another crust into his mouth.
"There's one he's finished," the scholarly attorney said,
and pointed at another corner of the room where another piece of plywood was propped up. I went to examine it. At one end, the figure of an angel with wings and flowing drapery had been executed in bas-relief in what looked like putty.
"That one is just drying," the scholarly attorney said. "When it gets good and dry, he'll color it. Then he'll shellac it. Then the board will be painted and a motto put on it."
"Very pretty," I said.
"He makes statues of angels, too. See?"
And he went to a kitchen safe and opened it, to expose a shelf of dishes and pots and another with an array of gaudy angels. I examined the angels. While I did so, the scholarly attorney took a can of soup, a loaf of bread, and some soft butter out of the safe, put them on the table in the center of the room, and lighted one of the burners on the two-burner plate in the corner.
"Will you join me in my supper?"
he asked. "No, thanks," I said, and continued to stare at the angels.
"He sometimes sells them on the street,"
he said, pouring out his soup into a stewpan,
"but he can't bear to sell the best ones."
"Are these the best ones?" I asked.
"Yes,"
the scholarly attorney replied, and added,
"They're pretty good, aren't they?"
I said, "Yes," for there wasn't anything else to say. Then, looking at the artist, asked, "Doesn't he make anything but angels? What about Cupid dolls and bulldogs?"
"He makes angels because of what happened."
"What happened?"
"His wife,"
the scholarly attorney said, stirring the soup in the stewpan.
"On account of her, he makes angels. They were in a circus, you know."
"No, I didn't know."
"Yes, they were what you call aerialists. She did the angel act. She had large white wings," George said.
"White wings," George said through the bread. But it was a sound like,
"White wings."
And he fluttered his big hands like wings and smiled.
"She fell down a long way with white wings which fluttered as though she were flying,"
the scholarly attorney continued, explaining patiently. "And one day the rope broke," I affirmed.
"Something went wrong with the apparatus. It affected George very deeply."
"How about the way it affected her?" The old man ignored my wit and said,
"He got so he could not perform his act."
"What was his act?"
"He was the man who got hanged."
"Oh," I said, and looked at George. That accounted for the big neck, no doubt. "Then did the apparatus go wrong with him and choke him or something?"
"No," the scholarly attorney said. "The whole matter simply grew distasteful to him."
"Distasteful?" I said.
"Yes, distasteful. Matters came to such a pass that he could not perform happily in his chosen profession. He dreamed of falling every time he went to sleep, and he'd wet his bed like a child."
"Falling, falling," George said through the bread, with a sound like,
"Falling, falling,"
but still smiled brightly in the midst of the chewing.
"One day, When he got up on his platform with the loop around his neck, he could not jump. In fact, he could not move at all. He sank down on the platform and crouched there, weeping.
They had to remove him bodily and bring him down, the scholarly attorney said.
Then, for some time, he was completely paralyzed.
It sounds, I said, like that hanging act must have got pretty distasteful to him, as you so quaintly put it.
He was completely paralyzed, he repeated, ignoring my wit, through no physical cause. If,
he paused,
anything ever comes to pass from a physical cause. For the physical world, though it exists, and its existence cannot be denied without blasphemy, is never cause. It is only result, only symptom. It is the clay under the thumb of the potter, and we...
He stopped. The gleam which had started up fitfully in the pale eyes flickered out. The hands which had lifted to gesticulate sank. He leaned above the gas plate and stirred the soup. He resumed,
"The trouble was here,"
and he laid a finger to his own forehead.
"It was his spirit. Spirit is always cause. I tell you..."
He stopped, shook his head, and peered at me before he said sadly,
"But you do not understand."
"I reckon not," I agreed.
"He recovered from the paralysis," he said. "But George is not exactly a well man. He cannot bear high places. He will not look out the window. He covers his eyes with his hands when I lead him downstairs to go on the street to sell his artistic work. So I take him down only rarely now. He will not sit on a chair or sleep in a bed. He must always be on the floor. He does not like to stand. His legs simply collapse and he begins to cry. It's fortunate he had always had this artistic bent. It helps him to take his mind off things. And he prays a good deal. I taught him to pray. That helps. I get up and pray, and he says the prayers after me, when he wakes at night with the dreams and cannot sleep."
"Does he still wet the bed?" I asked.
"Sometimes,"
the scholarly attorney replied gravely. I looked at George. He was weeping silently, the tears running down his smooth, flat cheeks, but his jawbone was not missing a beat on the bread. "Look at him," I said. The scholarly attorney looked at him.
"Stupid, stupid,"
he muttered fretfully, shaking his head, so that an additional flake or two of dandruff floated down to the black serge collar.
"Stupid of me to be talking that way with him listening. Stupid, I'm an old man, and I forget."
And clucking and muttering and shaking his head in that same fretful fashion, he poured some soup into a bowl, took a spoon, and went to George.
"Look, look," he said,
leaning with a spoon of soup thrust toward George's face.
"Good. It's good soup. Soup. Take some soup."
But the tears continued to flow out of George's eyes, and he didn't open his mouth. But the jaws weren't working on the bread now. They were just shut tight. The old man set the bowl on the floor, and with one hand still holding the spoon to George's mouth, with the other he patted George on the back soothingly, all the while clucking with that distraught, hen-like, maternal little noise. All of a sudden he looked up at me, the spectacles hanging over, and said peevishly like a mother,
"I just don't know what to do. He just won't take soup. He won't eat much of anything but candy, chocolate candy. I just don't know."
His voice trailed off. "Maybe you spoil him," I said. He put the spoon back into the bowl, which was on the floor beside him, then began to fumble in his pockets. He fished out, finally, a bar of chocolate, somewhat wilted from the heat, and began to peel back the sticky tinfoil. The last tears were running down George's cheeks while he watched the process, with his mouth open in damp and happy expectation. But he did not grab with his chubby little mitts. Then the old man broke off a piece of chocolate and placed it between the expectant lips and peered into George's face while taste buds, no doubt, glowed incandescent in the inner dark and glands, with a tired, sweet, happy sigh, released their juices, and George's face took on an expression of slow, deep, inward, germinal bliss, like that of a saint. "Well,"
I almost said to the old man. You said the physical was never caused, but a chocolate bar is physical, and look what it's causing. For to look at that face, you might think it was a bite of Jesus and not a slug of Hershey's had done it. And how you going to tell the difference, huh? But I didn't say it, for I was looking there at the old man, who was leaning over with his spectacles hanging and his coat hanging and his belly hanging from the leaning, and who was holding out another morsel of chocolate, and who was clucking soft, and whose own face was happy, for that was the word for what his face was. And as I looked at him, I suddenly saw the man in the long white room by the sea. The same man, but a different man. And the rain of the squall driving in off the sea in the early dark lashed the window panes, but it was a happy sound and safe, because the fire danced on the hearth and on the window panes where the rain ran down to thread the night-black glass with silver, to mix the silver with the flames caught there too, and the man leaned and held out something and said, "Here's what Daddy brought tonight, but just one bite now." And the man broke off a piece and held it out. "Just one bite. For your supper's near ready now, but after supper." I looked at the old man over there, and my guts went warm, and a big lump seemed to dissolve in my chest, as though I had carried a big lump around in there for so long I got used to it, and didn't realize it had been there until suddenly it was gone and the breath came easy. "Father," I said, "Father." The old man looked up at me and said querulously,
"What? What did you say?" "Oh, Father, Father."
But he wasn't in the long white room by the sea anymore, and never would be, for he'd walked out of it.
Why? Why?
Because he wasn't enough of a man to run his own house, because he was a fool, because... And he had walked a long way and up the steps to this room, where an old man leaned with the chocolate in his hand and happiness, if that was what it was, momentarily on his face. Only it wasn't on his face now. There was just the faint peevishness of an old person who hasn't quite understood something said. But I had come a long way, too, from that long white room by the sea. I had got up off that hearth rug before the fire, where I had sat with my tin circus wagon and my colored crayons and paper, listening to the squall-driven rain on the glass, and where Daddy had leaned to say, "Here's what Daddy brought tonight." And I had come to this room, where Jack Burden leaned against the wall with a cigarette in his mouth. Nobody was leaning over him to give him chocolate. So looking into the old man's face, answering his querulous questions, I said, "Oh, nothing." For that was what it was. Whatever it had been was nothing now. For whatever was is not now, and whatever is will not be. And the foam that looks so sun-bright when the wind is kicking up the breakers lies streaked on the hard sand after the tide is out and looks like scum off the dishwater. But there was something, scum left on the hard sand. So I said, "Yeah, there was something."
"What?"
"Tell me about Judge Irwin," I said. He straightened up to face me, blinking palely behind the spectacles as he had blinked at me upon coming from light into the darkness of the Mexican restaurant below. "Judge Irwin," I repeated, "you know, your old bosom pal."
"That was another time," he croaked, staring at me, holding the broken chocolate in his hand.
"Sure it was," I said, and looking at him now thought, "It sure God was," and said, "Sure, but you remember."
"That time is dead," he said.
"Yeah, but you aren't."
"The sinful man I was who reached for vanity and corruption is dead. If I sin now, it is in weakness and not in will. I have put away foulness."
"Listen," I said, "it's just a simple question. Just one question."
"I have put it away. That time," he said, and made a pushing gesture with his hands.
"Just one question," I insisted. He looked at me without speaking. "Listen," I said, "was Irwin ever broke? Did he ever really need money, bad?" He stared at me from a long way off, across the distance, beyond the bowl of soup on the floor, over the chocolate in his hand, through time. Then he demanded,
"Why? Why do you want to know?"
"To tell the truth," I burst out without meaning to, "I don't. But somebody does, and that somebody pays me the first of the month. It's Governor Stark.
Foulness,
he said, staring across whatever it was between us.
Foulness.
Was Irwin ever broke? I said.
Foulness,
he affirmed. Listen, I said, I don't reckon Governor Stark, if that's what all this foulness stuff is about, takes it to the Lord in prayer, but did you ever stop to think what a mess your fine, goddamn, plug-hatted, church-going, Horace-quoting friends like Stanton and Irwin left this state in? At least the boss does something, but they sat on their asses. They...
All foulness,
the old man uttered, and swept his right arm wildly before him, the hand clutching the chocolate hard enough to squash it. A part of the chocolate fell to the floor. Baby got it. If you meant to imply, I said, that politics, including that of your erstwhile pals, is not exactly like Easter week in a nunnery, you're right. But I'll beat you to the metaphysical draw this time. Politics is action, and all action is but a flaw in the perfection of inaction, which is peace, just as all being is but a flaw in the perfection of non-being, which is God. For if God is perfection, and the only perfection is in non-being, then God is non-being. Then God is nothing. Nothing can give no basis for the criticism of thing in its thingness. Then where do you get anything to say? Then where do you get off?
Foolishness. Foolishness, he said. Foolishness and foulness.
I guess you're right, I said. It is foolishness. But it's no more foolish than all that kind of talk. Always words.
You speak foulness.
Nope, just words, I said, and all words are alike.
God is not mocked,
he said, and I saw that his head was quivering on his neck. I stepped quickly toward him, stopping just in front of him. Was Irwin ever broke? I demanded. He seemed about to say something, his lips opening. Then they closed. Was he? I demanded.
I will not touch the world of foulness again,
he said, his pale eyes looking steadily upward into my face.
That my hand shall come away with the stink on my fingers.
I felt like grabbing him and shaking him till his teeth rattled. I felt like shaking it out of him. But you can't grab an old man and do that. I'd gone at the whole thing wrong. I ought to have led up to it and tried to trick him. I ought to have wheedled him. But I always got so keyed up and on edge when I got around him that I couldn't think of anything but getting away from him. And then, when I had left, I always felt worse until I got him out of my mind. I had muffed it. That was all I got. As I was going out, I looked back to see Baby, who had finished the piece of chocolate dropped by the old man, meditatively moving his hand about on the floor to locate any stray crumbs. Then the old man leaned slowly and heavily toward him again. Going down the stairs, I decided that even if I had tried to wheedle the old man, I would probably have learned nothing. It wasn't that I had gone at it wrong. It wasn't that I burst out about Governor Stark. What did he know or care about Governor Stark? It was that I had asked him about the world of the past, which he had walked away from. That world and all the world was foulness, he had said, and he was not going to touch it. He was not going to talk about it, and I couldn't have made him. But I got one thing. I was sure that he had known something, which meant that there was something to know. Well, I would know it, sooner or later. So I left the scholarly attorney and the world of the past and returned to the world of the present, which was an oblong field where white lines mathematically gridded the turf, which was arsenical green under the light from the great batteries of flood lamps fixed high on the parapet of the massive arena. Above the field, the swollen, palpitating tangle of light frayed and thinned out into hot darkness, but the 30,000 pairs of eyes hanging on the inner slopes of the arena did not look up into the dark, but stared down into the pit of light, where men in red, silky, glittering shorts and gold helmets hurled themselves against men in blue, silky, glittering shorts and gold helmets, and spilled and tumbled on the bright, arsenical green turf like spilled dolls, and a whistle sliced chillingly through the thick air like that scimitar through a sofa cushion. Which was,
the band blaring, the roaring like the sea, the screams like agony, the silence. Then one woman scream, silver and soprano, spangling the silence like the cry of a lost soul, and the roar again so that the hot air seemed to heave. For out of the shock and tangle and glitter on the green, a red fragment had exploded outward, flung off from the mass tangentially to spin across the green, turn and wheel and race, yet slow in the out-of-timeness of the moment under the awful responsibility of the roar. Which was a man pounding me on the back and screaming, a man with a heavy face and coarse dark hair hanging over his forehead, screaming, "That's my boy! That's Tom! 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 That's him, and he's won! They won't have time for a touchdown now. He's won! His first varsity game, and it's Tom won! It's my boy!" And the man pounded me on the back and grappled me to him with both arms, powerful arms, and hugged me like his brother, his true love, his son, while tears came into his eyes and tears and sweat ran down the heavy cheeks, and he screamed, "He's my boy! And there's not any like him. He'll be all American. And Lucy wants me to stop him playing. My wife wants him to stop. Says it's ruining him. Ruining him, hell. He'll be all American. Boy, did you see him? Fast. Fast. He's a fast son of a bitch. Ain't he? Ain't he?" "Yes," I said, and it was true. He was fast, and he was a son of a bitch. At least if he wasn't a son of a bitch yet, he'd shown some very convincing talent in that line. You couldn't much blame Lucy for wanting to stop the football. His name always on the sporting page, the pictures, the freshman whiz, the sophomore thunderbolt, the cheers, the big fat hands always slapping his shoulder, Tiny Duffy's hand on his shoulder. "Yeah, boss, he's a chip off the old block." The roadhouses, the thin-legged, tight-breasted little girls squealing, "Oh, Tom! Oh, Tom!" The bottles in the tourist cabins, the sea roar of the crowd, and always the single woman scream, spangling the sudden silence like damnation. But Lucy did not have a chance, for he was going to be all-American, all-American quarterback on anybody's team. If bottle and bed didn't manage to slow down too soon, something inside that 180 pounds of split-second, hair-trigger, Swiss-watch beautiful mechanism, which was Tom Stark, the boss's boy, the sophomore thunderbolt, Daddy's darling, who stood that night in the middle of a hotel room with a piece of court plaster across his nose and a cocky grin on his fine, clean, boyish face, for it was fine and clean and boyish, while all the hands of Papa's pals pawed at him and beat his shoulders, while Tiny Duffy slapped him on the shoulder, and Sadie Burke, who sat a little outside the general excitement in her own private fog of cigarette smoke and whiskey fumes, a not entirely unambiguous expression on her riddled, handsome face, said, "Yeah, Tom, somebody was telling me you played a football game tonight." But her irony was not the sort of thing Tom Stark would hear or understand, for he stood there in the midst of his own gleaming, golden, private fog of just being Tom Stark, who had played in a football game. Until the boss said, "Now you go on and get to bed, son. Get your sleep, son. Get ready to pour it on 'em next Saturday." And he laid his arm across the boy's shoulder and said, "We're all mighty proud of you, boy." And I said to myself, "If he gets his eyes starry with tears again, I'm going to puke." "Go on to bed, son," the boss said. And Tom Stark said, "Sure," almost out of the side of his mouth, and went out the door. And I stood there in what was the present. But there was the past. There was the question. There was the dead kitty buried in the ash heap. So I stood later in the embrasure of a big bay window and looked out as the last light ceased to gleam from the metallic leaves of magnolias, and the creamy wash of the sea beyond dulled in the thickening dusk. Behind me was a room not very different from that other long white room giving on the sea, where now, at this moment, perhaps, my mother would be lifting to the taffy-haired young executive that face, which was still like a damned expensive present, and which he had damned well better admire. But in the room behind me, scarcely lighted by the stub of a candle on the mounted shelf, the furniture was shrouded in white cloth, and the grandfather's clock in the corner was as severely mute as grandfather.
but I knew that when I turned around there would also be, in the midst of the sepulchral sheetings and the out-of-time silence, a woman kneeling before the cold blackness of the wide fireplace to put pine cones and bits of lightwood beneath the logs there. She had said,
"No, let me do it.
It's my house, you know, and I ought to light the fire when I come back like this. You know, a ritual. I want to. Adam always lets me do it when we come back." For the woman was Anne Stanton, and this was the house of Governor Stanton, whose face, marmoreal and unperturbed and high above black square beard and black frock coat, gazed down in the candlelight from the messy gold frame above the fireplace, where his daughter crouched, as though at his feet, rasping a match to light a fire there. Well, I'd been in this room when the governor had not been the marmoreal brow in the massy gold frame, but a tall man sitting with his feet on the hearthrug with a little girl, a child, on a hassock at his feet, leaning her head against his knee and gazing into the fire, while his large man hand toyed deliciously with the loose silken hair. But I was here now because Anne Stanton, no longer a little girl, had said, "Come on out to the landing. We're just going back for Saturday night and Sunday, just to build a fire and eat something out of a can and sleep under the roof again. It's all the time Adam can spare, and he can't spare that much often now." So I had come, carrying my question. I heard the match rasp and turned from the sea, which was dark now. The flame had caught the fat of the lightwood and was leaping up and spewing little stars like Christmas sparklers, and the light danced warmly on Anne Stanton's leaning face and then on her throat and cheek as, still crouching, she looked up at me when I approached the hearth. Her eyes were glittering like the eyes of a child when you give a nice surprise, and she laughed in a sudden, throaty, tingling way. It's the way a woman laughs for happiness. They never laugh that way just when they're being polite or at a joke. A woman only laughs that way a few times in her life. A woman only laughs that way when something has touched her way down in the very quick of her being, and the happiness just wells out as natural as breath and the first jonquils and mountain brooks. When a woman laughs that way, it always does something to you. It doesn't matter what kind of a face she has got, either. You hear that laugh and feel that you have grasped a clean and beautiful truth. You feel that way because that laugh is a revelation. It's a great impersonal sincerity. It's a spray of dewy blossom from the great central stalk of all being, and the woman's name and address hasn't got a damn thing to do with it. Therefore, that laugh cannot be faked. If a woman could learn to fake it, she would make Nell Gwynn and Pompadour look like a couple of campfire girls wearing bifocals and ground gripper shoes and with bands on their teeth. She could set all society by the ears, for all any man really wants is to hear a woman laugh like that. So Anne looked up at me with the glittering eyes and laughed that way while the firelight glowed on her cheek. Then I laughed too, looking down at her. She reached up her hand to me, and I took it and helped her as she rose, easy and supple. God, how I hate a woman who scrambles up off things. And I still held her hand as she swayed at the instant of reaching her full height. She was very close to me, with the laughter still on her face, and echoing somehow deep inside me, and I was holding her hand, as I had held it a long time back, 15 years back, 20 years back, to help her up to stand swaying for an instant in front of me, before I could put my arm around her and feel her waist surrender supplely to the cup of my hand. It had been that way, so now I must have leaned toward her, and for an instant the trace of the laughter was still on her face, and her head dropped a little back, the way a girl's head does when she expects you to put your arm around her and doesn't care if you do. But all at once the laughter was gone. It was as though someone had pulled a shade down in front of her face. I felt as you do when you pass down a dark street and look up to see a lighted window, and in the bright room people talking and singing and laughing with the firelight splashing and undulating over them, and the sound of the music drifts out to the street while you watch, and then a hand, you'll never know whose hand, pulls down the shade, and there you are, outside. And there I was, outside. Maybe I should have done it anyway, put my arm around her. But I didn't. She'd looked up at me and had laughed that way, but not for me. because she was happy to be there again in the room which held the past time of which I had been a part indeed, but was no longer a part, and to be kneeling on the hearth with the new heat of the fire laid on her face like a hand. It had not been meant for me, so I dropped her hand, which I had been holding, and stepped back and asked, "Was Judge Irwin ever broke, bad broke?" I asked it quick and sharp, for if you ask something quick and sharp out of a clear sky, you may get an answer you never would get otherwise. If the person you ask has forgotten the thing, the quick, sharp question may spear it up from the deep mud, and if the person has not forgotten, but does not want to tell you, the quick, sharp question may surprise the answer out of him before he thinks. But it didn't work. Either she didn't know, or she wasn't to be surprised out of herself. I ought to have guessed that a person like her, a person who you could tell had a deep inner certitude of self which comes from being all of one piece, of not being shreds and patches and old cogwheels held together with pieces of rusty barbed wire and spit and bits of string, like most of us, I ought to have guessed that that kind of a person would not be surprised into answering a question she didn't want to answer, even if she did know the answer, but maybe she didn't. But she was surprised a little. "What?" she asked. So I said it again. She turned her back to me and went to sit on the couch to light a cigarette and face me again, looking levelly at me. "Why do you want to know?" she asked. I looked right back at her and said, "I don't want to know. It's a pal who wants to know. He's my best pal. He hands it to me on the first of the month." "Oh, Jack," she cried, and flung her newly lit cigarette across to the hearth and stood up from the couch. "Oh, why do you have to spoil everything? We had that time back there, but you want to spoil it. We? I said. "Had something then, and then you want to spoil it. You want to help him spoil it, that man. We? I said again. "Wants to do something bad." "We," I said, "if we had such a damn fine time, why was it you turned me down?" "That hasn't anything to do with it. What I mean is..." "What you mean is that it was a fine, beautiful time back then, but I mean that if it was such a goddamn fine, beautiful time, why did it turn into this time, which is not so damn fine and beautiful, if there wasn't something in that time which wasn't fine and beautiful? Answer that one." "Hush," she said. "Hush, Jack." "Yeah, answer me that one. For you certainly aren't going to say that this time is fine and beautiful. This time came out of that time. And now you're nearly 35 years old, and you creep out here as a special treat to yourself and sit in the middle of a lot of sheet-wrapped, dust-catching furniture in a house with the electricity cut off, and Adam, he's got a hell of a life, cutting on people all day till he can't stand up, and him tied up in knots himself inside, and..." "Leave Adam out of it. Leave him out," she said, and thrust her hands, palms out, as though to press me off, but I wasn't in 10 feet of her. "He does something anyway. Something. And Irwin down there playing with his toys, and my mother up there with that Theodore, and me..." "Yes, you," she said, "you." "All right," I said, "me." "Yes, you, with that man." "That man, that man," I mimicked. "That's what all the people around here call him, what that Patton calls him, all those people who got pushed out of the trough. Well, he does something. He does as much as Adam, more. He's going to build a medical center. We'll take care of this state. He's..." "I know," she said wearily, not looking at me now, and sank down on the couch, which was covered by a sheet. "You know, but you take the same snobbish attitude all the rest take. You're like the rest."
"All right," she said, still not looking at me. "I'm snobbish. I'm so snobbish I had lunch with him last week."
Well, if Grandfather's clock in the corner hadn't been stopped already, that would have stopped it. It stopped me. I heard the flame hum on the logs, gnawing in. Then the hum stopped, and there wasn't anything. Then I said, "For Christ's sake!" And the absorbent silence sucked up the words like blotting paper.
"All right," she said, "for Christ's sake!"
"My, my," I said. "But the picture of the daughter of Governor Stanton at lunch with Governor Stark would certainly throw the society editor of the Chronicle into a tizzy. Your frock, my dear, what frock did you wear? And flowers? Did you drink champagne cocktails?
I drank a Coca-Cola, and I ate a cheese sandwich in the cafeteria in the basement of the Capitol.
Pardon my curiosity, but..."
"But you want to know how I got there? I'll tell you. I went to see Governor Stark about getting state money for the children's home, and I..."
Does Adam know? I asked.
And I'm going to get it, too. I'm to prepare a detailed report, and...
Does Adam know?
It doesn't matter whether Adam knows or not. And I'm to take the report back to...
I can imagine what Adam would say, I remarked grimly.
I guess I